recognized for overlooking certain acoustical principles important in designing concert halls. After many attempts at minor adjustment, it became clear that the situation was hopeless. The problem had to be solved by brute force. The walls and balconies were torn out, along with the ceiling, 10,000 tons of building material in all, and carted to dumps. The repair took several years and millions of dollars to carry out, under the supervision of a new consultant. In its exhaustive coverage of the problems, the New York Times focused its attention on Leo Baranek. If BBN hadn't already diversified into computer research, the Lincoln Center debacle could have spelled its end. By the mid-1960s, however, the company's offices had expanded into a row of low, fairly nondescript buildings, mostly old warehouses that stood along a quiet side street near Fresh Pond on Cambridge's western edge. The offices had a casual architectural uniformity, best described as low-rent modernism, Mondrian without the colors. These were stripped-down, spare, box-like buildings whose flat roofs, few windows, and thin walls exuded simplicity and economy in design. Four of the buildings had been built for other purposes, mainly as warehouse space, before BBN bought and converted them into offices, shops, and laboratories. Building number 2 was designed by Bolt himself and had a couple of unusual features. Its foundation floated in the Cambridge mud, effectively isolating the entire structure from external vibrations. And it was designed for the kind of people BBN was hiring, academicians, whom Bolt expected to fill their offices with books. Therefore, he designed the new building to withstand an unusual amount of weight. There were corridors and enclosed footbridges between all of the BBN buildings, making it possible to follow a kind of meandering path through the complete row without going outside during the winter. For a while, BBN depended on borrowed steam piped in from an adjacent laundry to heat some of the quarters. Among the computer researchers were Wally Feurzeig and Seymour Papert, who were working on educational applications. Papert was a consultant to BBN for about 4 years in the late 1960s. While there, he conceived of and made the first rough design of a programming language that would be accessible to school-age children. The idea was adopted as a research theme by BBN's education group, which Feurzeig ran, and the language came to be called Logo. While the acousticians usually came to work in jackets and ties, the atmosphere on the computer side was decidedly more relaxed. "When we got into the computer business, we had the strangest people working for us," said Baranek. He appreciated the brilliance of the people Lick hired, but seldom felt comfortable around them. He recalled being invited to a New Year's Eve party at the home of a computer engineer around 1965. "It was like going to the Adams family house," Baranek said. "They were all in bare feet. The women were wearing tight-fitting clothing. I showed up with a tie on and had to take it off." Frank Hart was a notable exception. Conservative in his attire and prone to caution in general, Hart was at that time a computer systems engineer at MIT's Lincoln Lab. In 1966, BBN embarked on a campaign to hire him for its hospital computer project. Hart was an engineer with a reputation for making things happen. Tell him you wanted something built, and by God, you would have it. But Hart was also hard-headed and not easy to pry away from Lincoln. A self-described overprotected Jewish kid from Yonkers, Hart was bookish and, in high school, a bit of a nerd. Frank wanted desperately to attend MIT, which posed a problem for his parents, who were of modest means. Through the Depression, Hart's father managed to keep his job as an engineer for Otis Elevator. The thought of sending her only son to a school so far away was particularly difficult for Frank's mother, who did most of the overprotecting. MIT admitted him in 1947, but with a scholarship so small as to guarantee continued financial struggles for his parents. Following the example set by his father, who built elevator control systems, Frank had decided to become an electrical engineer before entering MIT. To ease the financial strain on his family, he enrolled in a 5-year master's degree program, in which work and school were combined in alternate semesters. He worked one summer at a General Electric factory testing large power transformers. "That was something you went to do just once," Hart recalled. In his second year, he chose to specialize in power engineering, the design of large-scale electrical systems, such as power plants, building transformers, generators, and motors. Then he discovered computers. In 1951, Hart's senior year, MIT offered its first course ever in computer programming, taught by a visiting professor named Gordon Welchman. Hart signed up. "It was an unbelievable revelation to me that a thing like a computer could exist," Hart said. He dropped out of the work-study program, a decision that shocked many people because it was such a difficult program to get into. "I got all sorts of nasty letters from MIT and GE," but he'd caught the computer bug and never looked back. Thanks to Welchman's introduction, Hart became so interested in computers that he earned his bachelor's degree one term early and finished his master's degree while working as a research assistant on the Whirlwind project. Whirlwind controlled a radar defense system for tracking aircraft. A radar, radio detection and ranging, system measures electromagnetic pulses reflected from an object to provide information concerning its direction and distance. Jamming devices can destroy data from a single radar, but an array of radars can compensate if they are working in concert with a computer. Whirlwind gave Hart his first taste of programming in a real-time environment. When Whirlwind was transferred to Lincoln Lab, Hart was transferred with it. "It was the most painless kind of job change one could imagine," Hart said. Many programs in the 1950s were written in machine language, the actual instructions in the natural language of the computer. Commands had to be specified in exhaustive detail. There was a one-to-one correspondence between each line of the program and each instruction to the machine. Working in machine language could be tedious, and mistakes were difficult to find and correct. But it gave programmers a strong sense of identification with the machine. Computer programming was still so new that few people understood its intricacies. Many who worked in the more traditional sciences ignored or dismissed those who were exploring computers as a science. Lincoln Laboratory was proving to be a perfect incubator for the kind of genius that ARPA would need to push computing into the interactive and interconnected age. It had already turned into a breeding ground for some of the most important early work in computing and networking. Many of its alumni, among them Licklider, Roberts, Hart, and others still to come, would play crucial roles in the design and development of the ARPA network. In the early days, computer programmers at Lincoln were poorly regarded. Only full-fledged physicists and mathematicians were allowed on the research staff, and many programmers left Lincoln as a result. But Hart broke through the prejudice. He started out as a graduate student programmer, became a staff member, and before long he was running a group. Hart also disregarded the rules. He had little tolerance for professional delineations and didn't take titles too seriously. When a young programmer named Dave Walden came to work at Lincoln, he was hired on with the title of technical assistant. The fact that this was not a staff-level post was clearly indicated on his security badge. Titles were important at Lincoln, and among other things, the badge kept him out of staff member seminars. Ignoring all that and flouting the protocol that assigned non-staff to the least desirable workspace, Hart set Walden up in an office with one of Walden's mentors, a young MIT graduate named Will Crowther. Crowther was a physicist turned computer scientist. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, Hart, Crowther, and others close to them worked on one groundbreaking project after another. In time, Hart and his team at Lincoln became experts at connecting a variety of measuring devices to computers via phone lines for information gathering. This in turn made them experts in building real-time computing systems. When a group of Hart's colleagues left to start MITRE Corporation in 1958, Hart remained firmly moored to Lincoln, partly because he had always disliked change, and partly because he loved what he was doing. He couldn't imagine ever having a more interesting job or a more talented group with which to work. In the summer of 1965, Hart met Danny Bobro, who had been working on artificial intelligence at BBN. Bobro suggested to Hart that he leave Lincoln for a job at BBN, overseeing a project to introduce computer technology into hospitals. When Hart declined, Dick Bolt stepped in. One of the reasons the principals at BBN were anxious to woo Hart was that he had a fruitful experience in putting together systems that worked efficiently in the field. The company needed someone like that. For all its innovation, BBN hadn't been very successful at turning its ideas into functioning, usable systems. The culture at BBN at the time was to do interesting things and move on to the next interesting thing, said one former employee. There was more incentive to come up with interesting ideas and explore them than to try to capitalize on them once they had been developed. Bolt invited Hart to his house. They had more meetings at BBN. They met at the local Howard Johnson's. Hart remained reluctant, but there were aspects of the BBN job that appealed to him. Like Licklider, Hart had always held what he described as a do-gooder's view. Hart believed computers and technology could help society. Wedded as it was to the military, Lincoln Lab had never gone very far afield of the Air Force's needs. In fact, the lab's narrow focus had precipitated the departure of people like Ken Olson and Wes Clark, who left to build computers. Hart was also interested in the application of computers to the life sciences, and Bolt let him know he would have the opportunity to pursue that interest at BBN. Moreover, a friend of Hart's from Yonkers, Jerry Elkind, was at BBN, and Hart respected Elkind quite a bit. "It also occurred to me," Hart admitted, "that there was a chance I could make some money at a private corporation." In the end, Bolt convinced him to take the job, but by the time Hart got to BBN, the company's computer research was being carried out by two separate divisions, Information Sciences and Computer Systems. As a general rule, those with PhDs worked in the Information Sciences or Research Division, while those without PhDs worked in the Computer Systems Division. One member of the Information Sciences Division described the Computer Systems Division as consisting of a bunch of guys with soldering irons. In other words, they just got things built, while those in the Research Division considered themselves more concerned with inventing the future. There was not much cross-pollination between the two groups. They worked in separate buildings divided by a narrow, glass-enclosed footbridge. It wasn't animosity exactly that separated them, nor was it rivalry. Each was aware of the other's limitations, resulting in a conspicuous lack of interest in what happened in the other camp. Frank Hart was a systems guy through and through. When ARPA's request for proposals to build the IMP arrived at BBN in August 1968, the company had 30 days to respond. Jerry Elkind, who was now Hart's boss, was in charge of both computer divisions. He thought BBN should bid, and he thought Hart was the best person at the company to manage it. Since the demise of the hospital computer project shortly after he had arrived, Hart had been searching for a long-term project in which to immerse himself. Moreover, Hart probably had the most experience in building the kind of computer system that ARPA was seeking. Nonetheless, when Elkind suggested he take it on, Hart was typically cautious. Hart could be difficult to interpret at first. Alex McKenzie, who worked for Hart on and off for 27 years, recalled the first time he encountered his new boss, from the other end of a hallway. Hart was speaking in a loud, high-pitched voice to someone else, and seemed agitated. "He was really yelling, and I thought it must be trouble," Mackenzie recalled. "Then later I found out it was simply enthusiasm." A few years later, while on an airplane with Hart, Mackenzie finally told him about his initial impression. Hart raised his eyebrows. "Yelling?" Hart yelled, his voice reaching for its trademark falsetto, loud enough to attract the attention of everyone around them. "I don't yell!" Not, that is, when angry. "When he's angry, he gets very quiet," Mackenzie said. Meetings with Hart occasionally involved a lot of shouting. "And then, the next day, it turns out he's heard what you said through all the yelling and shouting," recalled another long-time employee. "If you were willing to put up with the yelling and shouting, he made things come out right, unlike most people who yell and shout." Hart had prodigious energy, which made it difficult for him to sit still for more than a few minutes at a time. He was most relaxed when he was at home, working in his basement woodworking shop, where he whistled long, complex pieces of music flawlessly, seldom aware that he was doing so. When things were tense or uncertain, he bit his fingernails or drummed his fingers on tabletops. Hart was intensely loyal to the people who worked for him, and they in turn were loyal to him. He was also nurturing, not just toward his three children. He happily took on many childcare chores not expected of husbands in those days, but also toward his employees. At the same time, he took a lot of things personally, particularly when people left his group to go work somewhere else, even if it was only across the hall to another division. One of Hart's greatest strengths was making certain that jobs he signed up for really got done, and in taking on the ARPA job, he was concerned about the risk of committing the company to something it might not be able to accomplish. The project was packed with uncertainties and unexplored technology. Hart found it difficult to gauge exactly what was involved. There wasn't time to do the kind of detailed planning he'd like to do on a system software project, such as estimating the number of lines of code that would be needed. Risk assessment is essential in any engineering enterprise. Because no significant technological project can be entirely risk-free, the probabilities for success and failure of particular designs are factored and weighed. The potential for trouble falls into three categories: the foreseen, the unforeseen but foreseeable, and the unforeseeable. In the last case, engineers are forced to make decisions with their fingers crossed. The situation facing Hart fell largely into this last category, since so much of the system had no precedent on which to base risk estimates. The software uncertainties were serious enough, but a plethora of other unknowns existed. For example, how much traffic could such a network handle without encountering logjams? What was the chance that the failure of one node would propagate through the network? In November 1965, for example, one overloaded relay caused a ripple effect that brought down the electric power grid serving the entire northeastern United States. Above all, what was the probability that the network would even work? Signing on for a project like the ARPA network required a certain amount of sheer faith, and that disturbed Hart. Elkind was motivated by his sense that ARPA was pushing the state-of-the-art of computing into a new era, and from a business point of view, it made a lot of sense to launch BBN toward that future. Elkind recognized that Hart's concerns were rational. "But it struck me that this was a contract we had to do, and could do as well as anybody," Elkind said. "We knew how to work with ARPA and had computer skills as good as anyone around." Elkind suggested to Hart that a small group from BBN get together to decide what to do with ARPA's request for proposals. They agreed to meet informally and chose Danny Bobrow's house in Belmont as the location. The first meeting went well into the night. By the time it was over, Hart was converted, and BBN's participation had been as much as guaranteed. That was the easy part. They then had just 1 month to write a detailed proposal. One of the first people to get involved with the proposal was Bob Kahn, a professor of electrical engineering on leave from MIT and working in BBN's Information Sciences Division. At MIT, Kahn had been an applied mathematician, working on communications and information theory. Most of his colleagues possessed a combination of theoretical and applied engineering skills. One day, Kahn had been talking with a senior colleague at MIT about the different technical problems in which he was interested, and he asked, "How can you tell when one problem is more interesting than another?" "It's just experience," Kahn's colleague responded. "How does one get that?" Kahn inquired. "Find someone who has a lot of experience and go work with him." One obvious place for Kahn to acquire that experience was BBN, so he went. By coincidence, in 1967, at the time that Larry Roberts was in Washington formulating the network project and its requirements, Kahn was at BBN having his own thoughts about networking. Still more coincidentally, at Jerry Elkind's urging, he had been sending unsolicited technical memos to Bob Taylor and Roberts. When Roberts told Kahn that ARPA was planning to fund a nationwide network, it was a pleasant revelation to Kahn. Then Elkind told him that a group in the BBN Computer Systems Division was interested in putting together a proposal for the ARPA network, and suggested that Kahn get involved in the process. Not long afterward, Frank Hart wandered over to Kahn's office. "I understand from Jerry that you've been thinking about the networking area. Can we chat about it?" "Yes, sure," Kahn responded. "Who are you?" In 1968, BBN had more than 600 employees. Frank Hart's group occupied a row of offices along a stretch of linoleum-tiled corridor in Building Number 3. At one end of the hall was a conference room with plenty of chalkboards and seating for large gatherings. The offices themselves were small and unassuming, with the desks fashioned from doors to which legs had been attached by BBN's construction shop. Stiff-backed wooden chairs and canvas-backed director's chairs were the preferred styles. Fluorescent lighting, a few personal effects, lots of shelves, and little else completed the picture. Hart liked working with small, tightly knit groups composed of very bright people. He believed that individual productivity and talent varied not by factors of 2 or 3, but by factors of 10 or 100. Because Hart had a knack for spotting engineers who could make things happen, the groups he had supervised at Lincoln tended to be unusually productive. One of the first people Hart called upon to help with the IMP proposal was Dave Walden, who had followed Hart from Lincoln to BBN. Though young, with only 4 or 5 years of programming experience, Walden had a highly cultivated expertise in real-time systems, ideal for the ARPA network job. Next, Hart drafted Bernie Cosell, a young programmer who had been working in BBN's Computer Systems Division. Cosell was a debugger par excellence, someone who could go poking around in a computer program he had never seen before, and in 2 days fix a problem that had gone unsolved for weeks. Hart also enlisted Hawley Rising, a soft-spoken electrical engineer who was an old friend from Hart's student days at MIT. Hart's hardware ace was Severo Ornstein, a 38-year-old Lincoln alumnus who had worked for Hart on and off for years. Ornstein was an intense man of many and diverse interests. The son of a virtuoso pianist and prominent composer, Ornstein had attended Harvard and had flirted briefly with a major in music before his parents argued him out of it. He finally settled on geology. After leaving Harvard, Ornstein had become interested in computers and had gone to work at Lincoln. When his colleague Wes Clark left for Washington University in St. Louis to build a computer of his own design, Ornstein went with him. After 3 years in St. Louis, Ornstein itched to return to Cambridge, so he called Hart, who offered him a position at BBN. When the request for proposals arrived from ARPA, Hart handed a copy to Ornstein and said, "Why don't you take this home and have a look at it, see what you think?" Ornstein returned to Hart's office the next day and said, "Well, sure, I suppose we could build that if you wanted to, but I can't see what one would want such a thing for." Nevertheless, Ornstein thought the IMP building project looked like fun, which was always a primary consideration for him. Hart had a predilection for judging people not by their looks or manners or political views, but almost purely by how smart he believed them to be. Or, as he liked to put it, by how many neurons per cubic centimeter their brains contained. If he decided the number was unusually high, Hart was likely to tolerate a lot more idiosyncrasy in one than in another whose gray matter he thought was less densely packed. When talking, Hart often used computer jargon in non-technical circumstances. "It's a no-op," he might say to his wife, Jane, if they decided to leave a Sunday afternoon free. No-op, or no-operation, refers to a line of code that accomplishes nothing. Or he might say, "It's binary," to one of their small children, meaning it is a black-and-white situation. Hart's knack for putting together effective engineering teams had made him a highly regarded and valuable project manager. He looked for people who would be committed to a common mission rather than a personal agenda. He preferred to keep teams small so that everyone was always talking to everyone else. Hart chose the kind of people who took personal responsibility for what they did. And while Hart tolerated idiosyncrasy, he shied away from egocentric head cases, no matter how smart they were. In assembling BBN's team for the ARPA proposal, Hart made certain he pulled in engineers with all the requisite skills for such an ambitious undertaking. Kahn, for instance, was the consummate theoretician. He, more than anyone at BBN, understood the problems associated with sending information over telephone lines, and he had clear ideas about the best error control mechanisms. Ornstein was a perfectionist, and it showed in the hardware he built, while Walden brought with him both his knowledge of real-time systems and a resolute willingness to work long hours. Cosell had the ability to burrow into complex software programs and find bugs faster than anyone else at BBN. Because of this, Cosell was one of the company's human insurance policies. Projects would be worked on by teams, but every BBN manager knew that if his project got into trouble, he could throw Cosell into the job and superhuman things would happen in a hurry. Although there remained a great deal of detailed design work, among them the team members understood the most important technical issues. As the team got started, Hart already knew what was in store. 4 weeks of working around the clock. Hart was expected home for dinner every evening at 6:30, and he always made it. But after dinner, he disappeared into his study and didn't emerge until long after his family had gone to bed. An important initial decision was which hardware to use. Reliability was, by far, Hart's chief concern. His 15 years at Lincoln Lab building antennae and radar systems for the military had taught him to worry about reliability above all else. Intuitively, Hart believed that the graduate students who would be knocking around the IMPs at the university sites wouldn't be able to keep their hands off the equipment. He had been a student, and he had probably even done the very kinds of things he feared. Hell, he knew they would try to do. They'd go poking around in the box to see how it worked. Hart's choices were limited. The mini-computer industry was still relatively young. Its leaders were Digital Equipment and Honeywell. From the start, the reliability issue led Hart to favor the new Honeywell DDP-516, the machine housed in the heavy-duty steel cabinet. The Navy had a reputation for setting rigorous engineering standards. And some of BBN's people knew some of Honeywell's people, who made the machine at a plant not far from BBN's Cambridge location. The 516 also helped to settle Hart's fear that inquisitive graduate students might bring down the network with their tinkering. He could rest much easier knowing the imps would be housed in a box built to withstand a war. The functionality of the Honeywell computer's sophisticated input-output I/O capability, the speed and efficiency with which it could communicate with external devices such as modems, also helped propel it to the top of the list. As the handling of I/O traffic was the main function of the imp, a machine with a good I/O structure was absolutely essential. Not long into writing the proposal, Dave Walden began feeling that he might be out of his depth. As the first programmer Hart brought to the project, Walden did a lot of the early thinking about general coding issues, and he did some of the original charts sketching out in block form the logical flow and timing of the program. Walden had outlined enough of the program to realize they were undertaking something difficult. He decided that the ARPA proposal would provide a good excuse to recruit Will Crowther, the ingenious programmer for whom Walden had worked at Lincoln, to lead the software effort. Walden wasn't in the least reluctant to bring in someone above him. He was confident enough in his own talents to shrug off pecking order concerns that might worry a lot of other people. The two had worked closely at Lincoln, and Walden was happier to be on a team with Crowther than on one without him. And besides, Crowther was exceptional. Having Crowther on the team wouldn't just boost the chances of making the software work. Having Crowther at BBN would make doing the work more pleasant. Crowther was quiet, easy to work with, and when it came to writing code, he was downright inspiring. He was also Ornstein's good friend and rock-climbing companion. Crowther seemed to concentrate best while hanging from door frames by his fingertips, doing chin-ups, and he was known for his mathematical doodling. While others passed the time at lengthy meetings by drawing squiggles and curlicues, Crowther filled his page with a thicket of differential equations. Walden, Hart, and Ornstein were pretty sure that Crowther hadn't been entirely happy at Lincoln since Hart had left. Crowther liked working for Hart, and while reporting to Hart at Lincoln, he had grown accustomed to seeing things built. After Hart left, a lot of the people who had worked for him had gone back to less productive tinkering. Ornstein called Crowther and said, "Willie, you ought to come to BBN," to which Crowther readily agreed. In Crowther, BBN gained an invaluable addition. He specialized in producing complex, tightly written pieces of code, which were exactly what was required in the IMP. In fact, writing small, intricate bits of code was one of Crowther's greatest pleasures in life. His code was among the leanest anyone who worked with him had ever seen. Since the IMPs were to be hooked up to phone lines, with data constantly flowing in and out, the idea was to have a data packet arrive at an IMP, be processed, and immediately either be sent forward or placed in a queue to await its turn, all in less time than it took to snap your fingers. Every instruction took 1 or 2 millionths of a second, microseconds, to execute. Since every unnecessary instruction ate up 1 or 2 extra microseconds, each little task or piece of software code had to be written with intense frugality, using the fewest instructions possible. Central to the design of the network was the idea that the subnet of IMPs should operate invisibly. So, for instance, if someone seated at a host computer at UCLA wanted to log on to a computer at the University of Utah, the connection should appear to be direct. The user should not have to be bothered with the fact that a subnet even existed. The effect was similar to direct dialing in the telephone system, which freed callers from the annoyance of having to wait for an operator to make their connections. Like the maze of automated switching equipment at a phone company, the IMPs were to be transparent to the user. As Roberts described it in the call for proposals, each transmitting host looks into the network through its adjacent IMP and sees itself connected to the receiving host. To achieve that transparency, the network was going to have to be fast, free of congestion, and extremely reliable. These were relatively straightforward requirements that Roberts had written into the request for proposals, but no one expected that actually accomplishing them would be easy. However, one of the first things BBN's software team discovered was that they could make the code process 10 times the number of packets per second that Roberts was requesting. Before doing anything else, Crowther and Walden wrote the code for the inner loop, the heart of the program, and counted the number of instructions. Roberts would have been content with an inner loop of 1,500 instructions. Crowther and Walden used 150. From that, the two programmers calculated just how quickly the IMP could process each packet. With that information, they were able to predict how many packets could be moved per second. "We actually sat down and wrote the 150 lines of code, counted them, and then we knew," Crowther said. They had figured out the kernel. "We take the position that it will be difficult to make the system work," BBN wrote hedgingly in its proposal. In this cautious way, the BBN team let Roberts know that it didn't take for granted a task that was unprecedented in its complexity, revolutionary in concept, and filled with technical details of uncertain feasibility. Yet, the proposal then went on to demonstrate that BBN seemed to have the problem solved. By the time the proposal was finished, it filled 200 pages and cost BBN more than $100,000, the most the company had ever spent on such a risky project. The BBN team had covered so much of the design in the IMPs that a large fraction of the entire system was already clearly defined. BBN's finished proposal was more blueprint than outline. Its engineers had designed test programs and regular performance checks for IMPs and the network. They described how the network would handle congestion in the buffers, storage areas in the machines that served as waiting areas and staging areas for the flow of packets into and out of the network, and how it would recover from line and computer failures. They provided ARPA with flowcharts outlining how the IMP software would handle such difficult problems as timing and the continual updating of routing tables. They came up with detailed computations, equations, and tables that covered, among other things, transmission delays and the queuing of packets. It was all there for Roberts to see. The BBN team submitted its proposal on September 6, 1968, relatively certain that no one else had prepared a bid as detailed as theirs. Years later, when people who worked on the BBN proposal were asked how long it took to put the document together, some of them said honestly they thought it had taken 6 months. Hart's team had obviously done an impressive amount of extra spade work, resolving some problems Larry Roberts hadn't expected to see covered. BBN held another advantage, its relatively small size. Roberts didn't want to deal with a lot of bureaucracy, and the other proposals were fraught with it. The team Raytheon was putting forth, for example, spanned 5 layers of management. Roberts could see that just finding the right person with whom to talk over the slightest problem might require 12 phone calls. The BBN team, on the other hand, had a very simple hierarchy. Everybody reported to Hart, who handed out the tasks and saw that they got done. Hart had a boss, but he appeared to be giving Hart ample latitude to do as he pleased with his project. The first sign that BBN's bid was being taken seriously came when Roberts called a meeting to review parts of the proposal. Hart, Crowther, Kahn, and Ornstein, their spirits high, took the train to Washington. Hart tried, unsuccessfully, to convince Crowther to wear something on his feet besides sneakers. During the meeting, they defended and expanded on their proposal. Roberts tested, prodded, and poked the engineers to see if they had really thought deeply and thoroughly about the system. And his questions continued for some weeks afterward. "At some level, I thought that the continued questioning by Larry kept us thinking about the problems and continuing to fill out design details subliminally," recalled Ornstein. "But I think the more important thing was that we took it to heart more than the other contenders. We made the design our problem and did our best to find solutions we believed in, without bowing too much to the specifications others had put down. But for the most part, all they could do was wait. If Roberts had a favorite proposal, he wasn't letting anyone know it. It could take months before they heard anything definite. By mid-autumn, they all returned to what they had been doing before the proposal marathon. Time slowed down again. Crowther went caving, which, next to rock climbing and writing code, was his passion. Hart got home at dinner time and didn't go back to work. Conn was about the only one who, by force of habit, routinely kept working late into the night. Everyone was anxious. "I personally swung from certainty that our proposal couldn't be beaten," said Ornstein, "to a belief that there was no way we could win, given the size of BBN compared to the other contenders." Throughout the evaluation process, as the competition for the interface message processor got whittled down, the BBN team heard rumors through the ARPA grapevine, though never from Roberts himself, who remained sphinx-like. Naturally, they did a lot of second-guessing. In their more pessimistic moments, the BBN engineers were inclined to believe that since Roberts knew many of them from Lincoln, it might be difficult or awkward or impossible for him to award the contract to BBN. Nevertheless, ARPA did just that. When news reached Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy's office just before Christmas that a $1 million ARPA contract had been awarded to some local boys, Kennedy sent a telegram thanking BBN for its ecumenical efforts and congratulating the company on its contract to build the Interfaith Message Processor. Chapter 4. Head Down in the Bits. New Year's Day 1969 was the last time Frank Hart's group would be able to rest for quite a while. The following week, the contract to build the first interface message processors officially began. For a little more than $1 million, BBN would build 4 IMPs. The first was due at UCLA by Labor Day, followed by one every month through December. In 12 months, the network was supposed to be up and running, with 4 sites online. The BBN team had already done a great deal of work in generating the proposal. Now, looking ahead, they saw at least 8 more months of late nights and intensive systems engineering work. There were still many unknown challenges, a point emphatically underscored by BBN in its proposal. Furthermore, the members of Hart's team all had different ideas about how difficult building the IMPs would be. Hart encountered any number of skeptics, phone company people and academicians mostly, who didn't believe a packet-switching network would work. Building the hardware wasn't really the hard part, they argued. Rather, making it all work together, the systems part, was the trick. Even if you could integrate all the hardware and software and demonstrate the feasibility of a computer network, some pointed out, there still wasn't any profit in it for a company like AT&T or IBM, not as a business proposition. Who but a few government bureaucrats or computer scientists would ever use a computer network? It wasn't as if computing had a mass market like the television networks or the phone company. During the weeks before winning the bid, BBN's biggest doubt had been whether ARPA would entrust the job to such a small company. The members of BBN's team knew there was a lot riding on them now. If the IMPs didn't work, networking and packet switching would fall into the oblivion of failed experiments. Some people, other bidders mostly, expressed astonishment that little BBN had won the contract. "This kind of large systems job just didn't seem to be up BBN's alley," said one competitor. By and large, Hart ignored the detractors, although he too worried occasionally about the technical challenges that lay ahead. To be effective, a data network would have to send packets reliably, despite errors unavoidably introduced during transmission over ordinary phone lines. Human ears tolerate telephone line noise, which is often barely audible, but computers receiving data are nitpickers about noise, and the smallest hiss or pop can destroy small bits of data or instruction. The imps would have to be able to compensate. Then there were circuit outages to anticipate, especially if the four-node experiment expanded coast to coast as ARPA envisioned. A spot of bad weather somewhere, a thunderstorm in the Midwest, or a New England blizzard would knock out service on a long-distance phone line carrying network data traffic. Brief interruptions in service couldn't be prevented. It would have to be dealt with by the imps. On top of that, in the best of conditions, there was a vastly complicated matrix of routing problems to be resolved. Hart's team had to prevent messages from circulating endlessly in the network, bouncing from node to node without ever reaching their final destination. Finally, the team had to consider the possibility of jam-ups in the memory buffers. Messages could be a maximum of 8,000 bits. IMPs were to break such messages into a sequence of packets with a maximum size of 1,000 bits each. One packet would contain the equivalent of about two lines of text on this page. The system had to deliver packets and messages within the time specifications Roberts had set. Half a second for a message to go from any source host to any destination host via the IMP subnet. It would mean processing data at speeds on the order of 100 messages per second, which was certainly possible, although synchronizing everything would be difficult. As if the technical challenges weren't enough, the ARPA network project schedule was on a fast track. The schedule set by Roberts was tied to the budget cycle and political realities facing him in Washington. 8 months weren't enough for anyone to build the perfect network. Everyone knew it. But BBN's job was more limited than that. It was to demonstrate that the network concept could work. Hart was seasoned enough to know that compromises were necessary to get anything this ambitious done on time. Still, the tension between Hart's perfectionism and his drive to meet deadlines was always with him, and sometimes was apparent to others as an open, unresolved contradiction. BBN faced countless other issues that had pushed other bidders and potential bidders out of the running. Now, all these problems belonged to Frank Hart. "It's one thing when you plug a socket in the wall and electrons flow," said Bob Kahn. "It's another thing when you have to figure out, for every electron, which direction it takes." To Kahn's way of thinking, this summed up the difficulty of building a network that switched packets of bits, and did so dynamically. Kahn knew very little about hardware design. He was a scientist who mainly did conceptual work on system designs and architecture. Because he pondered the larger conceptual aspects of the problem perhaps a little more deeply than his colleagues, he worried more about the complexity of building the network. To Kahn, the network was more of an abstraction, perfectible and whole, than it was to the other team members, involved as they were in the actual programming and wiring of its many parts. The packet-switching concept opened a rich universe in which a theoretically oriented and trained engineer like Kahn could investigate a wide range of hypothetical scenarios. Kahn's analyses had already helped shape the ARPA network project. Kahn had contributed ideas freely to Larry Roberts, urging him to launch the ARPA networking experiment on a large scale using long-distance telephone lines. Other people had said a small-scale experiment would be fine to begin with. But Kahn had worried that nothing meaningful could be learned from a small experiment. Roberts agreed and decided on a transcontinental network of at least 19 nodes. You could certainly build a network experiment in a single laboratory if you wanted to. By this time, Donald Davies had finally been given the go-ahead and some funding to do just that at the National Physical Laboratory in London, using short lines, each hundreds of yards at most. Kahn was sure that a small network experiment wouldn't scale up, at least not in practical terms. He reasoned that short links in a laboratory wouldn't have the same real-world error rates and problems as the long lines used in the telephone system. The real goal was to link computer scientists, and eventually other computer users cross-country. So a real network would have to cover thousands of miles, and would have to be designed to handle packets, and correct phone line errors at a much higher rate than any small network. Robert seemed to trust Kahn's judgment. Before the request for proposals hit the streets and BBN became a bidder, the two men spoke occasionally. Once Kahn had been enlisted to contribute to BBN's proposal effort, he worked into the early morning hours, night after night, occasionally in Severo Ornstein's living room, helping to design the system for BBN's bid. The work paid off, BBN won the contract, and Kahn had already decided to return to his own research work after Christmas. But as the new year rolled around, Kahn began to have second thoughts. The technical issues were complicated. Perhaps he should stick around for the implementation. It couldn't hurt. Besides, Kahn was eager to learn more about the hardware side of things from Ornstein, and moving over to Hart's shop was the only way for Kahn to continue his own network research, or so the folks who ran BBN led him to believe. Jerry Elkind, the man to whom both Hart and Kahn reported, urged Kahn to join the IMP group because Hart now had the one contract at BBN specifically devoted to networking. Although he continued to report to Elkind, Kahn moved to Hart's systems group. Soon he found himself picking up his office and crossing over the BBN footbridge from Bolt's scholarly haven into the redesigned warehouse where the group of young men who had started calling themselves the IMP guys were already hard at it. And guys they were. In keeping with the norms of the time, with the exception of Hart's secretary, the people who designed and built the ARPA network were all men. Few women held positions in computer science. Hart's wife, Jane, had quit her programming job at Lincoln to raise their three children. The team Hart had assembled knew how to make things that worked, if not perfectly, then well enough. They were engineers and pragmatists. All of their lives they had built things, connected wires, and made concepts real. Their ethos was utilitarian. At its core, all engineering comes down to making trade-offs between the perfect and the workable. Functionality mattered now, not elegance or beauty. Unlike, say, fine Swiss watchmakers, whose engineering and art are inseparable in a $40,000 watch, Hart's team naturally separated artistry from the craft of building a reliable computer. Looking down into the bits, lesser engineers with larger egos might attempt to show off, to infuse the mechanism with art, to create some wonder of engineering, a gold-inlaid, filigreed marvel of complexity. In the inner strength of Hart's team was its restraint, its maturity. This was no place for signature craftsmanship. "There was an infinity of ways we could go wrong, and a substantial number of ways to go right," said Walden, the first programmer Hart had signed on. "Good engineers find one of the ways of going right." The real-time radar systems, the systems for seismic detection of A-bomb tests and earthquakes, and the other systems that Hart, Ornstein, Crowther, and Walden had all worked on at Lincoln Lab, had been more complicated than the IMP. Years later, some people would say that the IMP was nothing but a big I.O. device, and actually very simple. To the user, the IMP was to be as simple as an electrical outlet or a wall switch that does its job without calling attention to itself. Then again, building the IMP to perform as well and as unobtrusively as a household socket or switch was precisely the challenge. The software team had been working together closely since the proposal. Each member had a specific role. Crowther worked on IMP-to-IMP communications. Walden concentrated on the IMP-to-host issues, while Cosell worked on development and debugging tools. Willie Crowther, 32 years old, quiet but opinionated, was the soul of the team. In the first few weeks of 1969, Crowther did a lot of hanging from office door frames. Everyone around him just accepted the behavior as Willie's way of warming up. It helped strengthen his hands for rock climbing and seemed to help his thinking even more. Crowther's style, recognized by the rest of the team, was to appear as if he were doing nothing for days, or doing just a lot of door-frame chin-ups, before finally releasing in a torrent whatever had been forming in his mind. If Crowther and his colleagues were confident about their programming and software design, Ornstein was equally confident about directing the hardware effort. He was responsible for designing high-speed I.O. devices that BBN planned to add to the Honeywell 516. The considerable effort that he'd already invested in drafting the proposal was time well spent. After making only a few further refinements and finishing touches, the team would be ready to move into the hardware construction and programming phases of the project. Ornstein's first task was to bring the hardware design to a point where he could go to Honeywell with a set of detailed modifications to the 516. After that, Honeywell would start to build the specialized I.O. devices the imp needed to communicate with the hosts and other imps. The imp team had to decide which network operations would be handled by the imp software and which would be hardwired, or built into, the imp hardware. Simple tasks that had to happen quickly were best handled by hardware. But once designed and built, a piece of equipment was harder to modify than any piece of software. So as a rule, the imp guys favored software solutions. If something could be done fast enough in software, they did it there, designing the system to give themselves more leeway for revisions later on. By February, BBN had firmed up its contract with Honeywell for the purchase of the DDP-516s. Within days, Honeywell delivered and installed the first 516 computer in a room at the front of BBN's Moulton Street complex. This machine wasn't the modified, military-grade version on order, but a plain vanilla, off-the-shelf 516. It was a tester, the development machine, with which the programmers would experiment as they set to work. Programmers are usually not willing or able to go far in writing code for a specific computer until the actual hardware it will run on is at hand. Ornstein had just begun the process of working out all the final details of the specialized I.O. interfaces. It might be weeks before Honeywell could make those interfaces available to conduct experiments. Like virtually all computers of its era, the Honeywell machine had no disk, no hard drive, no floppy. Floppies hadn't been invented yet. It had a core memory, a dense matrix of hair-thin copper wires and magnetized ferrite rings, or cores, each about the size of a mustard seed. The total size of the memory ordered, 12K, was minuscule by today's standards. The amount of memory in a desktop computer circa mid-1990s, if it consisted of ferrite cores, would take up an area roughly the size of a football field. One interesting advantage of core memory is its non-volatile nature. If you turn the machine off in the middle of working on something, it wouldn't lose its place. It would pick right back up again where it had left off. Hart's team had also designed an automatic restart feature. If the power failed, the machine was supposed to come to a clean stop and then restart automatically when power returned. With the core memory, the machine would restart at the beginning of the program as soon as power was restored. The only time a program had to be reloaded was when a new release was issued or when some hardware or software glitch caused the memory to be overwritten. In these cases, the IMP program would be reloaded from a paper tape reader, a kludgy electromechanical device which shone light from an incandescent bulb through a paper tape that was pulled across a line of photocells. The imp had other self-sufficiency measures, one of which was called a watchdog timer. If the program went wild, Hart explained, a small timer in the machine would run down to zero, but a healthy program would continually reset it. If the timer reached zero and went off, the imp was assumed to have a trashed program. It would then throw a relay to turn on the paper tape reader, give it a while to warm up, and then reload the program. BBN would ship each machine with a copy of a tape that had three copies of the entire imp operating program in sequence, giving each imp the chance to do three auto-reloads before someone had to go and rewind the tape. Later, an even more ingenious scheme would be invented by BBN to reload crashed imps from the nearest neighbor imps and start fresh. These were all unusual features at the time. The imp guys set to working on writing the code, and by the time they were finished, it would turn out to be about 6,000 words. "A tiny program," said Hart. They did all their programming in Honeywell 516 assembly language. Computers are instruction-following mechanisms. Assembly language programming requires thinking through a vast number of minute steps, then writing the instructions to carry them out. For instance, let's say you want to find the elevator. An equivalent set of instructions in a high-level language might go something like this. Go out the door, turn right, go past the water fountain, and it's on your left. The equivalent in assembly language would begin more like this. Find your left foot. Find your right foot. Place your left foot in front of your right foot. Now place your right foot in front of your left foot. Repeat this 10 times. Stop. Turn 90 degrees to the right. Etc. To program in assembly language was to dwell maniacally on the mechanism. It was easy for programmers to lose sight of the larger goal and difficult to write short, economical programs. Unskilled programmers often ended up writing assembly language programs that wandered aimlessly, like some hapless Arctic expedition in a blizzard. Crowther managed to keep the detailed steps of assembly language programming straight in his head without getting lost. But he was forever drawing big flowcharts so he could picture everything at once. One colleague likened the process to designing a whole city while keeping track of the wiring to each lamp and the plumbing to every toilet. Sometimes, though, Crowther eschewed the flow diagrams and did them in his head. Where others struggled to apply the rudimentary programming tools of the time, Crowther was out there operating on a higher plane. Writing the IMP software began in the offices of the programming team members, where each would type code on a Model 33 teletype into a PDP-1 editor.